Sleepy Salsa here on this Friday, March 1st of 2013. And welcome to the 71st episode of the Last Bastille podcast. This broadcast is kindly hosted over at radioforall.net. I should also take this opportunity to mention that the opening theme is Ashley Alicize's A Puzzling Predicament and her A Dangerous Situation, both of them available pursuant to Creative Commons attribution, specifically CC BY NCSA 3.0 unported. For more information on Creative Commons, visit them at creativecommons.org. For any other content that may not be of original authorship by yours truly, any such material is used under the sincere intention of fair use. If you wish to understand the nature of the situation we are all suffering under and what can be done about it, feel free to visit the Last Bastille blog, which is located over at The Last Bastille. Bastille is spelled B-A-S-T-I-L-L-E. TheLastBastille.wordpress.com. And this is the episode that was supposed to be about security teams, and it still is. However, I would first like to inform all of you just where the direction is going that I'm currently taking with podcasting, really. And I think the best way to start is really by just kind of mentioning what Outpost of Freedom Radio is. OPF Radio got started pretty much at the beginning of this year, and it's taken up a good portion of my time, which is why I've been delaying so long about doing the this episode on security teams. And really what happened was pretty much because with OPF Radio, since we were going to do an episode on security teams anyway, we had debated about doing it earlier, and so we just, let's just do an OPF Radio episode about it. So that's what we did. And so what you're going to be hearing in a few minutes is the actual episode we did, I did with Outpost of Freedom Radio about security teams, which is still with Gary Hunt. That's still true. But I just kind of want to describe kind of where the Last Bastille podcast is going. Now, do keep in mind that OPF Radio is a continuation of sorts of You Have Tread on Me Radio. And so there's basically kind of a team called the Y Team, of which I'm now a part of, where we're basically going to be putting together, we're going to work collaboratively together and put together these episodes of OPF Radio, which is really nice, too, since the software we're using for this is off of Spreaker.com. And so a lot of us are going to work together to try and kind of take podcasting to the next level by having a well-oiled, good machine for doing live streams with a concomitant chat room and that sort of thing. And so I would encourage all of you to listen to OPF Radio, which is located at outpost-of-freedom.com/radio. outpost-of-freedom.com/radio. And I'll also put it in the description box on R4A. But yes, once you start hearing the episode, which will be just in a few moments, you'll hear a title announcement, and then there'll be the intro music, and then you'll hear the actual, episode. And then the outro is going to be Visitor from the Past, which is pretty typical for what we're doing at OPF Radio in terms of intros and outros and stuff like that. But, this Security Teams episode was originally aired back on January 21st of this year. So I know I've been kind of lackadaisical on getting this one up, because originally it was going to be, I was considering having it being an episode of the Last Bastille podcast, but kind of like what I did a while back with the internal balkanization episode, where it was just simply a rebroadcast of one of Randy Max's YHTOM episodes, which I believe was Gary Hunt exposed, John Doe 4 at OKC. Similarly, this security team's episode is basically going to be a rebroadcast of that OPF radio episode of the same name. So the only other thing I want to say before we get started is just to let you folks know, so for the time being, the Last Bastille podcast is going to be on hiatus because all my time now is taken up with OPF radio. I would encourage all of you to listen to not only Outpost of Freedom Radio, but also a kind of separate but related series brought to you by the Y Team, which is known as Behind Enemy Lines. And that follows the tradition of classical podcasting, where which is basically what the Last Bastille podcast really was, really is, still is, especially particularly these last couple episodes where it's just been me reading articles and whatnot. But especially the Behind Enemy Lines series too, which I think would be good for all of you. So, but for now, the Last Bastille podcast is going to be on hiatus, and a lot of my efforts are going to be diverted, well, I shouldn't say diverted, but allocated towards Outpost of Freedom Radio, as well as the separate but related series of Behind Enemy Lines, also brought to you by the Y Team. And, you know, at some point in the future, if something happens with OPF Radio or I happen to get more spare time, I'll probably maybe make some episodes just exclusively for the Last Bastille podcast. But for now, just understand the Last Bastille podcast is now on hiatus officially as of today on March 1st. So without further ado, here's your episode on security teams. As always, I'm Sleepy Salsa, and thanks for listening. This broadcast of OPF Radio on January 21st of 2013 is about security teams. Gary Hunt is the guest, and your host is Sleepy Salsa. And that was A Dangerous Situation by Ashley Alasai. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this particular episode of OPF Radio. If you think about it, self-preservation and defense, whether collective or individually, is about as fundamental an instinct that man can have. Absent such instinct, what else is left? Your life does not belong to you, nor does your property. Absent those, even your thoughts are without meaning. All rights, liberties, and any other notions of freedom are only to be maintained by the willingness of individuals to use physical force against criminals and tyrants alike. It is upon this foundation of the individual right of self-defense that the collective form emanates. Gary Hunt, who is an active patriot for 30 years, will be discussing with us tonight about a security team that he was a member of, as well as laying out the fundamentals of the concept that is a security team. With that said, let us go to our guest. Gary, are you with us?
Yes, I am. All right. How are you this evening, Sleepy?
I'm doing quite well, sir. Let's go ahead and jump
into it. Déjà vu here, huh?
I guess you could say that. Let's go ahead and jump into it. Gary, what is a security team?
Well, a security team, let's see. Second Amendment guarantees the right to militia, and the foundation of that goes back really to the Magna Carta and the right of self-defense, that our right of individual self-defense or self-defense of our family has to be inherent, because without life, no rights have any meaning at all. Militia is a collective in the community level, and it's administered by the civil authority that exists in that community. Security teams is something that we created a security team back in 1992, somewhere in between the two. It wasn't me, it wasn't the other members, but we all came together to provide a security team for our self-defense should the need arose. Now, the reason we did that is I had prepared to publish the Outpost of Freedom newspaper, and George Sibley and Linda Lyon were already publishing Liberatus magazine. And some friends of ours felt that, you know, we might be creating a risk for ourselves because we were writing basically on our government stuff. And this is relatively early on. Most of the Patriot community back then was IRS involvement, but we were going beyond that. They had done some articles on the 14th Amendment. I'd done some on, you know, the government control of taking children from people and Operation Monarch. So the concern about us was that we might get hassled by the government. So six of us, the six men in the team, met one Thursday at my office. We agreed to meet there, and then we went to a restaurant and sat down and started developing this plan around the security team. It was rather loose at the time. And now George had asked if his wife Linda could join the team as well, because she was the co-editor of Liberatus magazine. So we agreed, and then she came in the next meeting. And so the security team was basically formed. And its purpose, as I say, is somewhere between individual self-defense and militia. We're not subject to civil authority. We're a civil body in ourselves, looking to protect only ourselves. It's not an aggressive function. It's strictly a defensive function.
Okay, so what kind of operations does a security team perform?
Initially, you know, our idea, well, there were a couple concepts involved initially. One is the self-protection, and the other one is possible subsequent expansion of the security team to involve more people, but they would never be on the same tier that we were, but we'll leave that for a little later. The applications, except for defense, had not been addressed, and the first situation came up about mid-February. And I had published the first edition of Outpost of Freedom newspaper, and I'd been speaking with some people in California that we were working with, Ted Gunderson, Mark Phillips, and people like that, about ritual child abuse. And one evening, some people were at the office. A couple of them were members of the security team, even though it wasn't a security team meeting. And there was a knock on the door. And so I answered the door, and he said, "I'm Peter Chernoff." And I hadn't heard the name before, but I said, "Come on in." And he said, "No, you've got other people in there. Can you, I need to talk to you alone." So I asked everybody to leave, and then Peter came in, and then Linda and Alex and the person that drove that 3,000 miles from California came in. And Peter explained that he had fled California with his son Alex because Alex's mother wanted to put him in Miss Sandy's daycare, which is associated with Michael Aquino. He was on the board of directors of the Miss Sandy's daycare, and Alex was concerned, or Peter was concerned about Alex getting involved in ritual child abuse. My secretary had told me that she'd seen a white car going back and forth during the day, so I was kind of concerned about keeping him there, and so I called one of the security team members who lived alone and explained without saying too much that I needed to bring some people down there that needed a place to stay for the night. So we went down there, and I explained to him basically what was happening, and these people were being looked for by the FBI. And so he had no qualms. He took them into his house. They stayed there for 5 or 6 weeks, 7 weeks, I guess. And they were very comfortable. We had some rules. Peter could not use the phone for anything. If they went for a walk, they were supposed to go with somebody. You know, we had set some rules up. Now, see, all this stuff developed as we did it, so we wrote the rules as we went. But of the security team, only the person who they were staying with, myself, George, and Linda, knew about this, and George and Linda acted as security because I had my business and I had to be at the office 8 hours, at least 8 hours a day. And then March 5th, I went to Waco, and they were still staying with the security team. So the first application was hiding a Patriot from the FBI, which we did quite well. The FBI actually came to my office looking for Peter Chernoff once, and I don't want to say I lied to the FBI. Let me tell them, I didn't tell them the whole truth, and so they walked away from that investigation. At Waco, I was taking on the government, going on radio programs. I think I did over 100 during the time I was in Waco. I was putting out the fax releases and really putting the FBI on the spot with some of the things that I was writing, which were truthful. They weren't CNN stuff. So there was concern in the security team over my security when I came back, so we made arrangements. We reserved a flight to Denver, Colorado, and in talking with people, I said, I'm going to cancel my return to Florida and going to Denver. The FBI had moved in the room next to me, and we figured they'd tap the phones at the motel. And any communication about what was really happening was done payphone to payphone, Orlando to Waco, Texas. And so the arrangements were made, and the flight to Colorado would have been 2 hours after the Orlando flight. So the morning that I went up to Dallas-Fort Worth to get on the flight, we were talking quite loudly in my room. Well, let's get an early start. I want to have breakfast and relax before the flight. And I got there just in time for the Orlando flight. When I got to Orlando, security at Orlando at the concourse, beginning of the concourse, they had metal detectors. So nobody could, like it is today, this is back in 93. So nothing could be done in security area, but if I got through the security area, or even if I came out with somebody in the security, from the security area, then they could have acted. And so when I walked out of the security area, I just kind of glanced around this lobby, this long circular area, and over the, up and across and over to the right, I saw three members of the security team, and I knew they were armed. And so as we left, one of them got joined me, and the other two followed for a while to make sure we weren't being followed. And so that was the second application, and it came together beautifully, and it came through with a minimum and conversation that was outside of the normal. The next instance occurred when, when I got back, George and Linda didn't want me to go back to my house or my office because they were still concerned that something like happened. So they rented a motel room. I stayed in the motel room that night. George and Linda stayed with me, and they were on guard all night. One of them was awake all night long while I slept. My son came to visit me. I contacted him and got him to come down, and I actually had somebody contact him and had him come down to see me. And when he knocked on the door and the door opened, he was facing two people holding 9mm pointed at him, and it kind of shook him up, but he understood why. And we also did a little bit with the radio program, where the program was actually pre-recorded on the telephone, but it was treated as if it was live, even to the point of, it was a guy up in Sanford, not too far from Castlebury, where I was. He ran the tape on his radio show and said, well, Gary's not here yet, doing everything to make it sound like it was a live show. We were waiting to see if the doors busted down at the radio station, because the implication was I had walked in there and I was there, and it didn't happen. So that was something George and Linda created, just a little test to see if anything was going to happen. So after that, we felt comfortable. The next application of the security team came when I was up on the Indian Reservation, and George and Linda were arrested for killing Officer Motley of the Opelika Police Department. They had been using my fax machine while I was gone to fax out to people around the country, and you know, I'll be honest, I don't know that there this much concern was that necessary, but this is how well we functioned. When I finally got in touch with George and Linda when they were in jail, Linda said, you need to get your copy machine. She gave me the instructions, destroy it, take it out in the woods, destroy it, and find the chips and take them somewhere else and destroy them. So I called a member of the security team, told him how to get a key to my office, and I said, this needs to be done right away. Go to the office, get the fax machine, take it out in the swamp somewhere, take an axe, tear it into little pieces, look for all the electronic chips in it, take them somewhere else and throw them in the river or a creek. He called me back about 3 hours later and said, job's done. And so just to keep the list of, now I'm not sure that this was Linda's supposition. Both what was faxed out and the number it went to could be stored on the chip. And knowing what storing capabilities are today was quite true. And her concern was that. I don't know what she faxed on the machine, but the fact is the team responded beautifully in addressing a concern that had to be dealt with. So those are applications that came into being of necessity for the security team. None of them were aggressive. None were going after anybody else. All of them were completely defensive towards our team or protecting somebody from outside that gave his faith, handed the trust over to us to protect him from the FBI. So the applications of the security team really can't be anticipated, but if you have a good team, it can respond to any situation. We also, when I got back to my return from Waco, we set up what we call dead man calling. I had to call one of the team members by 5 o'clock every afternoon. And if I didn't, then they would begin looking for me. They would start calling around. Team member would go to the office or anything. Now, occasionally, if I was going to be somewhere at 5, I might call them early and say I'm not going to be here. Now, we continue to use, not the team, but I have used the same function with the dead man calling with other people because, hey, if I get arrested, who's going to know it? Now, the only way you can know it is if I don't make the call and then somebody starts looking into it. Otherwise, oh, well, I haven't heard from Gary for a week or two. I wonder if something happened. So the dead man calling system, call by a certain time, is a functional way. It's like the lawnmower switch. You take your finger off, the lawnmower stops. It's a functional way of providing security without having to see somebody to make sure. And we used it in one case on a 9 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the afternoon time interval. So these are applications of the security team. These are things that can be done by them. And hey, use your imagination or wait and see what happens. And if you have a good team, they will adapt to the circumstances.
Now, I guess the penultimate question, I guess that would be on the minds of militiamen, would be what are the differences between a security team and a militia unit?
Well, I don't think any of the members of our security team was in the militia, but there's no reason you couldn't be in a security team and the militia. Now, if the militia were properly formed, it would be subordinate to civil authority. But if you were called up to the militia, you would have to give that precedence over the security team. But the difference is the militia is defense of the community. It's done by the civil authority. It is a collective, but it includes people that aren't necessarily members. It has less security as far as intelligence security. I mean, we were a very secretive group. So militia has a function in life. But if people have particular concerns, are they going to rely on the militia? How about the local police? You know, was that old saying, the police are only minutes away when seconds count? The militia is the same way, but the security team is, let's say, a step beyond Minutemen. They are immediate. They're there and there is 30-second men, half-minute men. But their purpose is very limited. It is only for that concept of self-preservation. It is not an aggressive team. Though we contemplated in some of our discussions that under some circumstances possibly used as an aggressive or offensive team, we never really went anywhere with that. Had no desire to unless it was absolutely necessary and functional to defense. But a militia, now you're part of a team that's in military order. UCMJ, in theory, applies. The chain of command. The militia has these rigid set of rules, and you're in a command structure. You're not as flexible. I mean, look at the military. They started with in World War II with special teams. The British had the SAS, and we had the OSS, and then we went to special forces. We've got Rangers. We've got these CIA guys running out. They're acting more like a security team. They work everything out among themselves. They're detach from the militia. Well, that's in a sense what the security team is to they're detached from the military. The security team is not even attached in any way, shape, or form to the militia. But it operates with the close-knit communication and the camaraderie that you would see on a lot of these military teams, SEAL Team 6. Except not in the offensive manner. I don't believe in assassinating people, let me put it that way. No, I can't really say that. So the difference is very distinct, that one's apples, one's oranges, basically.
All right, well, I'm aware of those in the Patriot community who like to focus more on survival-type things. So, and I know a common concept is, you know, if you get a bunch of guys together and you go into, you know, your bug-out location and you defend that location, I know that's been kind of a concept that's been going around the circles for the past several years at least. So I guess the really key question for people who are more of that kind of mindset is, a survivalist retreat group a type of security team?
Well, I would say so. Now, when you hear bug out, though, most people have their own bug out plans, their own bug out bags, and they're not a cooperative group. But if you had and I don't like the term survivalist, because if something does happen in this country, I'm not trying to survive. I'm trying to return it back to what it should be. But, you know, the ethical background of survivalist retreat group and a security team might be different, and the moral background perhaps as well. But yes, a survivalist group would definitely be a security team if it was a group. Now, there's a group that I'm aware of, and I don't want to say where they have some land and they're shoring it up. But the problem, and here's where a difference comes in. If I was a security team survivalist retreat group, only the members of the group and their families would know. In fact, the children would not know. Only the people in the families that needed to know would know anything about anything. A survivalist group tends to advertise. What they've done is exposed themselves, quite frankly, to infiltration, here we get back to, you want to enlist people, get more and more people in. Survivalist retreat group obviously would be looking at, the more people we have, the better off we are, as long as they all bring their fair share into in terms of food and other necessities of the team. So in a way it's similar. It's a compact between people, but one has a uniqueness and lack of exposure, where the other one has commonality and complete exposure.
Right. Well, I guess the corollary to that would be, are there security teams that would not be a retreat group then?
A security team isn't designed. We didn't have a bug out location. We had an assembly point. If something happened and we felt the need, then everybody was. We had taken a quad sheet, you know, a geographic map, and marked three locations. I'm a surveyor, and I knew that we could get to all three of these fairly easily. They could be entered from different directions. They're almost unsusceptible to infrared because of the density of the vegetation. So we identified three locations, A, B, and C, for assembly points. They were called assembly points. They were not intended to be survival points. We were not looking at survival in that context at that time. I don't know if I would now. We had talked about other things. Where is food supplied in a food distribution warehouse? Where are guns stored in a gun shop? We looked at the means of acquiring means of survival, but we weren't looking at a camp-out situation for survival. We would have hid in plain sight after we got our act together and worked together in that capacity. So in that sense, we're different than the retreat group in that bug out was not even a part of the design. If they chose to, if they were a security team and had security, and instead of that, our assembly area decided that, and it possibly could be used for that they could go and live there almost without detection because of the density of the foliage, the availability of water. All you have to need is the food and the toilet paper and the necessities of life. They could create a survival group. So I don't want to say no in that one direction, but a survival group per se is not a security team unless it structures a security. So to answer your question, a security team could be a retreat group under certain circumstances, but the key element is it's not open, it's closed. Nobody knows about it except those that are members.
All right, well, I've been doing some book reports and all that and reviews of books on guerrilla warfare, and it's interesting, a common theme I keep seeing over and over again is the notion of the guerrilla band. And I've noticed other people, different types of political dissidents and people within the Patriot community as well, mentioning about guerrilla warfare. So I guess my next question would be, are guerrilla bands the same as a security team, or are they different?
I'd say they're completely different. A guerrilla band will have a command structure. Let's look at the Marquis in France during World War II, because it's probably the most well-known of guerrilla bands. There were guerrilla bands in the American Civil War, but in every case, there's a command structure. There's identification of targets. For example, the Marquis was, through certain contacts, was in touch with England all the time, primarily De Gaulle's people. But they were given targets, they were provided supplies and all this. So they are military in nature, and the same thing applies during the Civil War. These guerrilla groups, even though they ran independently quite often, they were also commissioned officers by the, at least the ones I'm aware of, by the Confederate government, and occasionally they were given a mission that they had to complete. So even though they were just outlaws in one sense, they were also a function of the military and the command structure. And some of the rewards from their excursions were turned over to the Confederacy. And I think in the Maquis, redistribution of supplies that were stolen to other units was there. So the guerrilla bands have to have a degree of security for their own protection, but they also have to have strings out. And apparently in a number of cases in the Maquis, those strings out could be compromised. The guy's willing to save his life to give up the people that he knows either downstream or upstream from himself, or maybe even set them up. So the difference is one has that chain of command and that structure and that networking with other people that creates the risk, where the security team, if it's properly developed, has no risk at all. Or just about, I should say, risk at all.
Okay. Well, does a security team need to standardize their weapons? Because I remember some, survivalist group, retreat groups and militia units occasionally quibbling with each other about, 5.56 versus 7.62 millimeter as far as their standard caliber or different things like that. So does a security team need to standardize their weapons?
Probably not. One of the security team members had a pistol, and I think all the time that we were formed, probably 7 or 8 months, never got the pistol out of the safe at his house. Only when you anticipate the need for the pistol, and that varies from person to person. George and Linda obviously were more than willing to carry out that role. But standardization, World War II, the government provided tens of thousands of what was called a Liberator. It was a little pistol that was sheet metal. To extract the cartridge, you had to take a wooden peg and push it out. And it came with, a handful of 45 bullets. The idea was quite simple. You take this, walk up to a German, shoot him in the head, grab his rifle and his ammo pouches, and you're armed. Do they need to be the same caliber? If you're going to be fighting a lot of combats, yes. But if you're a security team, you don't expect to get in a combat situation. So, no, I think that each person, in our case, we had a variety of weapons between us. And we never even thought of the need for standardization, because we're not going into combat going to need, 500 rounds of ammo.
All right. Well, speaking about, I guess, the organizational philosophy, I for lack of a better term, about this kind of thing, would it be accurate to say that a security team abides by the concept of leaderless resistance then?
To some degree, they abide by the concept of leaderless resistance. Now, the article on leaderless resistance, which should be getting posted in the chat right about now, the articles, leaderless resistance is more of a military force, and so somewhere along the line has got to extend its communication to involve other groups for larger missions or identification of certain targets. Where the security team is generally, if they're going to do anything, it's going to be resupply themselves, food, ammunition, weapons, anything, transportation, gasoline, water, whatever they need. So their purpose is a lot less in that respect. Now, leaderless resistance, the concept, and when you go into combat, it's almost impossible, in fact, it's true in almost anything. If you've ever served on jury duty, the jury always picks its own foreman, or is supposed to. And that person is picked because the other people judge this person thinks, and he, you know, he might give us a, for whatever reason, he's going to be the head of the group. Our security team had no such leadership, but if I'm going into combat, as leaderless resistance is described by Lewis Beam, then there has to be a higher degree of coordination and organization to it. And so it's a misconception to say leaderless resistance is without a leader. It does not have an external leadership. It does not have the chain of command. It might have communication for both acquisition of information and identification of targets. But generally, somebody's got to look at the situation on the ground and say, okay, three of you over there, because they've got some people out there, and one of you charge. He's got to be the sergeant, or however you want to look at it. Where the security team, if we ran into a situation, well, you pick a lead. For example, on my coming back from Waco, George and Linda were the lead. On hiding Peter Chernoff, I was the lead. On getting rid of the fax machine, nobody was really the lead. George and Linda, or Linda requested it. I passed it on to one of the other members, and the job was done. So we would have somebody that was the lead in something, the one that got us into something, unless he passed it off, generally would be the lead. So we didn't really have a leader, but in any situation, somebody had a better overview of what was happening and would be the coordinator for the effort. But in, again, back to leaderless resistance, you've basically got a combat team. And so you will probably pick somebody pretty competent because your life is going to be at risk in his hands. And it's not the variety of situations security team runs into. Generally, they're going to be combat type situations.
All right, so let's get a little bit more deeper into how a security team works then. So I guess a good place to start would be, how does a security team hold meetings?
Well, we were concerned about security, and you know, bugging devices nowadays can be about the size of a fat thumbtack or a push pin, and they can have many hours of life, and so it's easy to bug a table in a restaurant. So quite simply, my office was fairly central to everybody on the team. So every Thursday, whatever time it was, I don't recall what time we met now, we would meet at my office and we'd pull out the phone book, or somebody would suggest a restaurant and we'd go to that restaurant. So nobody knew where we were going until we decided to go. And if my office was bugged, they might go, but as soon as the decision was made, we got in our respective cars and drove there. Now, when we got there, we chose a table that gave us the best observation of both front and back doors and kept a constant lookout. We observed the actions of people that came in. We never noticed anything askew, but we were very conscious of security, and we didn't want to be bugged. We did talk about things that I will not talk about in public now, I can generalize in them. We did talk about some of the members looked at some of the grocery warehouses in the Orlando area, and how to best access them, where we could get close to them without being on their property, how we could get in, grab food supplies and get back out. Same thing with gun stores. There were a lot of things that individual members were doing and making notes of so that we had the means to operate. But our meetings were held without prior notice. And if we were concerned, we probably would not even have made the decision in the office for fear the office might be bugged. We'd probably go outside and play a radio and decide what restaurant to go to. But we never got in that heightened level. But we did talk on occasion about a heightened level of determination of where a meeting was going to be. But a public place like a restaurant we felt was ideal for it. And it was good business for a lot of restaurants in town, because I think we did use a couple of restaurants two or three times over the 7 or 8 month period. But generally, there was no pattern and nothing identifiable, so any effort at bugging where we were meeting would be non-existent. Now, our assembly area would have been out in the woods where it was impossible to bug us. They didn't know where it was. So, I mean, it's just it's common sense to do it somewhat along that line so that you avoid being bugged, because if somebody finds out the existence of a team, which I don't think anybody ever did, anybody that I ever knew never knew anything about this team, not even my son. He just thought George and Linda were helping me. So as long as you keep it a secret, there's and have no name to it, when you have a name, the governments can start looking, well, who are these Wolverines? Who are these Viper militia? Who are these? And they can go after it. And if they don't know of its existence, it's really hard to bug. They might be pursuing an individual there and try and use that. So there could be direction created by, say, mine or George or Linda's activity that they wanted to bug. But the meetings were never held in the same place for all intents and purposes, and they were never held in a private home or in my office.
All right, so I think you were kind of alluding to this a little bit earlier, but I hope you can go into more detail about this. How does a security team make decisions exactly?
Well, I talked about it in terms of who the primary person was in any of these operations. As far as the other decisions that were made at the meetings about how we were going to structure ourselves, what form of security we were going to provide, things like that, they were by consensus, but for the most part they tended to be unanimous. We talked as much as we had to with the pros and cons, and I don't think that we really ever, there was only one area that I can think of where there was a bit of controversy on dealing with a certain situation, and that had to do that if we created additional teams, I could create a team under me, but they would never know the existence of the other security team, the one that I was a member. They would think it was just me. However, if there was ever a call-up and we went to the assembly area, then I would have these people tell them, they would not know ahead of time like the rest of us did. Only I knew where the meetup area was, the assembly area. And when it was time to go there, if somebody, they would be brought together, and at that point, security lockdown, you might say. If somebody said, I got to call my wife and tell her, or let me go to the restroom, or anything. And this is where the question came in. It was finally resolved unanimously. What do you do with that person? You take your pistol and squeeze a bullet into his head. Because him wanting to go away from there might be a breach of security. And one of the members said, well, that's not fair. You're judge, jury, and executioner. And I said, look what's at risk. Or we all said, well, at least a few of them said, well, look what's at risk with the whole team. If we get an infiltrator in there, is it worse to get rid of one guy by mistake or risk the entire organization, the entire group? And he finally relented and said, yeah, I see your point. I think you're right. I'd do everything I could to avoid it, but I do see the necessity. If it seems that somebody wants to communicate, drops a piece of paper or anything, I guess the only choice we have is to get rid of them. But that was the only one that I can recall where there was even a question, and that probably went on for the whole lunch, an hour and a half or something, before we finally came to complete consensus, unanimous decision on on how that would apply.
Who is eligible to join a security team?
Well, there's an article I wrote a while back that should be posted up there. When you start a security team, you finish the security team. That's the only safe way. If you're looking at increasing your membership, you increase your risk. Ours just came together, you know, in a short period of time for a specific purpose. But it's people that you know and trust. However, there are things to look for. In fact, I want to get a link posted here for something that I've been working on. If somebody's been arrested and there was no disposition of their case, or, you know, they were charged with possession of marijuana or child abuse or something like that, and then nothing ever happened, you don't want that person on your team. You don't know what's behind it. If a guy's got a record, well, I had possession of marijuana many years ago, actually twice, once in Florida and once in Pennsylvania back in the 60s. You have to look closely. You cannot afford to allow anybody in that team that you have any doubts about at all. And once the team is formed, it's locked down. Like I said, I could have, or any one of the other members could have, created a sub-team that had no knowledge of the primary team. So any expansion would be without the knowledge of the original concept. You just don't bring people in after the fact. Now, there might be circumstances that, you know, say a design of a security team other than ours did want to bring in new members. Now, there's a link there for application for participation. It's something that I worked up at the request of some people a while back. What do we do if we do want to bring somebody in the group? This would apply to militia, not to committees of safety, but perhaps committees of safety subcommittees where things were being discussed that you don't want let out, but the committee of safety has to be open to anybody that's an American. There are certain restrictions that we implemented in Florida and South Bend, Indiana, as far as who could join the committee of safety, but it's generally open. But if you have a militia or a subcommittee or some kind of organization where you want to bring other people in, that application talks about a good approach to evaluating people that are coming in. If I made a sub-team and somebody wanted to come in that I didn't know, then I would probably have applied something the same to even the ones I knew, that everybody would be brought in that way. But I don't think I'd be inclined for that. I think if I made a team, it would be relatively small in people that I knew already. But you have to be very careful. Everybody wants numbers. We've got a militia and we're 300 strong. Well, who are those 300 people? I don't know. What do they look like? Well, that guy's picture on Facebook, he looks younger than he sounds, but I've never met him. Oh, well, shit. That's good security. Yeah. Look at these police officers who play like little girls or little boys to try and tie people on set. Anybody who relies on the internet for any communication to provide any form of security is, pardon my expression, an idiot. You have to, what that application recommends is first you have a meeting with them and don't even discuss the subject. If you're going to invite them into militia, you go meet them for a beer or a cup of coffee, depending on your moral convictions, I guess. But you sit down and talk with them about what sports do you like, you know, what are your hobbies. You don't even talk about the militia. You just get an idea of what he's like. And the beer, or especially the coffee, to some degree, loosens people up. You get relaxed, have a casual conversation that has nothing to do with the organization. Now, some of the people that have looked at this have said, well, that's not fair. You're asking all kinds of personal information from me. Well, if I want my electric turned on, I've got to have submitted all my personal information to a greater degree to somebody prior to that. I have to have a bank account. They've got my social security number. They've got my mother's maiden name. They got all kinds of stuff. If I want a job, I got to talk about criminal record, previous employment, and all that. And so this application, with the exception of the Social Security number, which we don't ask for, is asking to get an idea of the background. Now, you might have the background, and it might or might not be true. In fact, I was talking to somebody today, and it was a rather interesting conversation, because he was talking about the background of one of the officers in their group. And, this guy's background is phenomenal. What about his DD-214? Oh, he says that's a secret. Wait a minute. No, they're not. You can't get VA benefits without a 214. Now, I know some people who were in special services, and their DD-214 shows their duration of their service, the highest rank, MOS, things like that, but it does not mention some of the other things they did. They're classified, and they don't go on the 214. But if the guy was in military service, he's got a 214, unless he was in the Navy and perhaps the Marines, because they use a different form. But everybody, when they gets out, when they separate from service, gets some paperwork. And I think I got eight carbon copies when I got out of the service. I needed for VA, I needed for this, I needed for that. Anytime I had to prove I had service. So if a guy claims military service, he better have a 214 or he's probably a lying son of a bitch.
Okay, to follow up on that, though, should a security team actively recruit members then?
Well, not a security team, no. But, I mean, we're talking about this. If you decide in your security team you want to recruit people, which I think is foolish, then follow these procedures. If somebody has all these jobs, call. Somebody's applied to employment with us, and I want to talk to you about his work practices at your business. His name's Joe Smith, and he worked from you from then to then. Well, that guy never worked here. No, we don't have any record of him. You know, you track these things down. A few phone calls could save the security of your organization. And I would never recommend the security team recruit except on a different tier, as I've mentioned. And they would never recruit without having a good understanding of the nature of the people. I've known them for a long time without regard to the Patriot community. But you could use this application to do that, but the application is worthless unless you follow up on the information in the application. You know, I think there's more snipers, military snipers, on the internet than the Army's ever had. I'm not sure.
Okay, well, Gary, how should a security team securely communicate then?
Well, we had talked about different methods, but we never went beyond the meetings. Now, Sleepy, you and I have talked about this, and a lot of people use the internet now, and we're working on great distances. The problem is we really don't know who's on the other end. I don't know what you look like, Sleepy. I see different. Every time you change your picture, you're somebody else.
Back during the days when I had my own YouTube channel, I did make it an effort to give as a variety of theatrical appearances, yes.
But internet communication, if you did have to do it and had already assured that the person that you're working with is secure, PGP, which you've written about on your blog, is good. However, Zimmerman was charged with criminal activity back in the 90s or late 80s, somewhere back when PGP 3 or 4, somewhere in that era. And then the charges were dropped against him. They never took him to court, and they never went to prison. My knowledge, never paid any fines even. So he might well have given the government a back door to all the subsequent PGPs. Now, if you encrypt something off the computer, now when I say off the computer, it doesn't have to be off. You could do it in a word processor, or you might write a little routine. But the thing is, that's very secretive. You don't let that out. But if you encrypted something and it came out garbage, and then you encrypted the garbage in PGP, and sent it, and the government intercepted it. And remember, an email, if I send somebody an email, and don't trust hush mail any more than anything else, or this burn note or things like that, if somebody intercepts your email, you will never know it. And if PGP has given the back door, if they intercept your email, they'll decrypt it using the back door. Trouble is, when they've done decrypting it, because it's already been encrypted before you PGP encrypted it, what they get is garbage. So they might think that you changed the algorithm or something in it. They don't know where to go at that point. So double encryption, one off computer and one on computer, is probably the most secure way. This didn't, we're back in the fax days then, but and there's the old concept of using a mask in a written document. So you could fax and have a mask, but in the internet, double encryption would be the only way to do it. Phone communication, what we did quite simply out of Waco is I went down to payphone one day and I called a number that was one of the team members, that not one that I'd been talking to while I was in Waco, and I gave him, it was something like A, and then an area phone number, B, a phone number, C, a phone number, D, a phone number, and these were four payphones that I had access to. And this is when you could receive calls on payphones. A lot of payphones you can't receive calls on now. And then he called me back later with payphones in the Orlando area. And so if I called, say, George and said, B, at about 4 o'clock this afternoon, 6 o'clock your time, then George would be at that payphone B, and I would call him on his B phone number at that time. The likelihood of it being tapped in is almost non-existent, but technology's changed too, and if understanding by some people is correct, and it might be that all phone calls are stored in a complex in Salt Lake City, Utah, I think it is, but it, there was an article about it back in the 90s, that virtually all phone calls in, on hardwire in this country today go through a switching station in Salt Lake City. That means they can strip off the conversation and store it to use. There have been subsequent articles about that. Now, using code words and things like that can provide you a little protection. Staying away from keywords can provide a little protection. Handwritten cryptic notes can be used. But verbal communication is susceptible too, because they have these parabolic antennas and they can listen to a whispered conversation a couple hundred yards away unless the wind's blowing the wrong way for them. So what's, the only thing that's safe is getting away from people, like out in the swamp where our assembly area was, or having a radio going louder than your conversation so that a parabolic antenna would not pick up your conversation, and doing it out in the open. But communication is something that in each case, you have to, what do you have to communicate, that you should have something in advance that you can utilize to do your best. Now, if they're saving all these phone calls, that means somebody's got to listen to them, so they're going to keyword them or identify them by phone numbers. And so if I'm going payphone to payphone, they have no phone number to identify me with. You just have to think and think, how can we communicate without? Obviously, the best security in the world is a courier. Now, it didn't work very well for John Andre. Got him hung. But a written note or a verbal, or an oral message to a courier, he carries it to the other person and delivers it directly and only to that the recipient, is about the only safe communication, and that's assuming your courier hasn't been compromised. So communication is a serious problem. Face-to-face is the best, but even then you have to use security. Direct physical communication via a courier, whether it be oral or written, is probably second best. Anything beyond that is iffy at best, but if you think of how the government works, you can probably bypass things by avoiding keywords, and it does, it makes a lot of sense. One of the encryptions in the Revolutionary War just had keywords, that a tree would mean battle. You know, you just take some words, and you both have the key code. A tree means battle, water means army, and so you can write something about the tree is growing nicely. The battle is going on. Well, I guess you could think how they could be more applicable, but you can write a message that sounds like a social conversation and convey a lot of information.
Wow, that's quite fantastic. And, you know, perhaps maybe in the future we should do an episode on privacy and InfoSec or information security and things like that, because especially that suggestion you mentioned earlier about both having an online and an offline way of encrypting and decrypting messages is quite fantastic. Although kind of going along that line of thought, how does a security team weed out undercover operatives, agent provocateurs, and the assorted informants?
Well, if your security team is set up like ours, you wouldn't have to, because you would have nobody after the initial meeting, and if you were compromised, you're probably all out of the game from that point on. So, looking in a more general sense, if you had a different form of security team, if you had a committee of safety or something like that, how do you weed out people? I think one good way is quite physical, but you get the game cam. Actually, you don't even need a game cam. You just go out in the woods somewhere and you dig a hole, say 2 foot by 2 foot, and then you fill it back in and you place a rock on top of it and place a leaf under the rock. Just a small leaf under the rock. And then you have a new guy come in and you've checked him out, you feel comfortable with him, you want to give him a final check, you say, look, each cache has got 3 people assigned to it, and we only have 2 on this cache, so I'm going to take you out there and you're going to be the third member to know this cache. And he's going to say, well, what's in it? It's there if you ever need it. If things happen, the cache needs to be exposed. And you just don't answer the question, and don't say you can't answer it, just say it's there if you need it. So he's going to be curious as to what it is, and you take him out and show him where the boulder is, you know, where to park, where to walk, and here's the boulder, this is the cache. And then you take him back and say, if the need ever arises, somebody says, I need cache 13, you take them there, you know, or you go out there and secure the cache equipment and bring it back. Then you wait a few days, and then you go back out there and see if the leaf's still in place. It's kind of a simple one. Now, if you had a game can, a motion sensing game can, you could even set that up. But the idea is to test the guy when he's got the opportunity and him not knowing what's in the cache. Or if you want to make it real interesting, you could probably say, well, there's some hand grenades in there, but don't tell anybody. But you want to make him curious enough to see what really is in there. That's one way to test. What I said before about records, if they don't have a 214 and they've got military service, they're lying to somebody, themselves or to you, more than likely you than them. Maybe to themselves too, maybe it's pathological. In fact, I think you're aware of an instance that it seems that there was a pathological aspect to military service recently.
Yeah.
Interesting thing about agent provocateurs, I've been accused of being one for many years, but an agent provocateur, to be effective, has to first provoke you, and this happened with the Viper Militia, Hootering Militia, and everything else. He has to provoke you, and then he has to be there to testify. Since I don't join anything anymore, I can't be there to testify. I'm not party to any planning. I'm just an advocate of some pretty aggressive approaches to dealing with government. But that makes me an agent provocateur in the eyes of some people. But an agent provocateur is the one that starts suggesting things that go beyond the consensus of the group. It applies, in the case of Joe Sims, it applies to somebody who says, I can find somebody that can supply you the rice and gas. If a guy should not have access to rice and gas, and he says he has access to rice and gas, you have a serious question about him. All you got to do is pay attention and not be too greedy. I want dynamite. This guy says he can get dynamite. You got to think, should he have access to dynamite? If he wouldn't normally have access to dynamite, you better find out a lot about him before you let him supply you the dynamite, because once that dynamite is in your hands, you're the guilty party. Informants in a group is really hard to expose. We posted an article a link a little while ago. Let's post it again. Informants amongst us. It talks about some aspects of that. There's another one called Vortex that is is worth consideration. Number six, Vortex talks about types of informants and infiltration that occurs. These are the people that Vortex is the people that are the interface that's known by both sides, and the only one that's known by both sides. He's where everything swirls around, comes back out the other side. If there's ever any suspicion, let's go back to what happens when the team was going to assemble under an emergency situation. If there's ever any doubt, don't take the risk. Take the solution. Now, if it's a critical thing, now I got accused of being a bad guy once because somebody said I said kill a patriot because I said if they couldn't have stopped the guys that were going to dump the rising gas in the freeways in Atlanta any other way, then they should take him out in the woods and take care of him. And they said, I suggested killing a patriot. Well, if the guy wants to dump rising gas on the freeways in Atlanta, he's not a patriot, number one, so I'm not killing a patriot by a long shot. But if you're not sure and you've got, you know, 5, 3, 5, 10, 15, 20, 50 people who are at risk because of the possibility that one man's bad, if you can't isolate him and remove him from the equation, you may have to remove him completely. And that's the reality of survival. I know it's rather harsh, but you think of the Maquis in France, and one book I read years ago about that, the Germans, a lot of times, who could not get somebody to talk, would try and get the Maquis to think that they had turned informant. And then the Maquis would kill that person. There was an incident on the Sioux reservation back in the, I think it was in the 80s, Anna May Aquash, who was out of Canada. The BLM Indians, the traditional Indians, the BLM was working with the FBI. This is where Leonard Peltier was charged with killing FBI agents. But Anna May Aquash would not, as near as I can tell from what I've read about people who have investigated the story, she would not. Because she was a Canadian, the government tried to intimidate her into turning against the traditionals. She would not turn against the traditionals, and the FBI didn't like what she was doing, so either the FBI or the BLM Indians kind of leaked word that she was an informant to the FBI. Now, nobody's sure who killed her, but the FBI cut her hands off and sent them to Washington for fingerprinting. Nice way to fingerprint people. But she was found dead in the snow. She was probably a good guy on the traditional side, and the other side didn't like her, whether it was BLM or FBI. But anyway, she ended up dead. So some people can be set up to be in that at-risk position of appearing to be an informant. But are you better off? You know, it's a hard call. But when there's a lot at risk, you have to be extremely careful of what you allow to happen within your organization.
Now, earlier you were mentioning about, you know, veterans producing their DD-214s when they're asked, when they're joining an organization security team or what have you. So, how do you perform background checks on prospective members of the team?
Well, I'm not sure. I think that if you go to the U.S. Army page, for example, you can verify a 214. You'd have to give the name and service number. I don't know what information you have to get, and they'll verify that there is a 214. Whether the 214 is public or not, I don't know. Unemployment. Call the previous employer. Say, this guy's applied for a job with me. I want to find out what his background is. Talk to him. Make sure he worked there. Find your potential employer. Was he at work every day on time? Did you have any problems with him? Now, most employers are reluctant to say bad things because they might get sued nowadays. But in talking with the previous employers that he's put on the application, you'll get a picture of what this guy's like. He's very boisterous. He didn't get along with other people. I don't want him in my group. Criminal record. Every case, every charge brought against somebody has a final disposition. There was a guy named Charles Dyer. He was charged with having a grenade launcher. And I told the people that were supporters of Charles Dyer that I wouldn't not even get involved in the story until I see the disposition on the grenade launcher charge when he was charged with child abuse later. Finally, I got two copies. One was signed by the jury foreman, and the other one was signed by the court confirming the verdict of acquittal on the grenade launcher charges. If somebody's charged with possession of marijuana, he's going to get an acquittal, he's going to get a sentence, or he's going to get an adjudication withheld or something. If it's adjudication withheld, that is the typical on a plea agreement. As long as you perform on the plea agreement, we will not bring the charges against you, and after a certain time, you meet the certain hoops, you'll be okay. Now, informants against us has quotes out of a plea agreement that was offered to a friend of mine in Florida back in the 90s, and you'll see that they've got you by the proverbials when you sign a plea agreement. So if somebody has an adjudication withheld on a criminal charge that he admits to, now it's easy to do criminal checks on people nowadays on the internet too. It's available. I know some organizations actually have set up accounts, and you pay a dollar or something. It's a nominal charge to run criminal background checks on people. It might not give you all the information, but if there's a charge that he did not put on the list, you've got to find out why he didn't put it on the list, and then you've got to track it down and see what the final disposition was. If he doesn't have a copy of the disposition of acquittal, then you've got to find out if it was that he was sentenced, given probation, his probation's up. If he's still on probation, he still belongs to the government. You don't want somebody that's on probation or on parole in your organization because he still belongs to the government. But if he served his time, and then you're safe. But if it's adjudication withheld, that's the worst one. That means they're holding this hammer over his head. And if he doesn't comply with them, even to the point of lying to bust you, he goes to prison. And once he's compromised himself by signing the plea agreement, it's just a small step, not a big step, to turn and lie about somebody that he's working with. So the bottom line is you follow through. When if you're doing a background check on somebody, don't just ask him, don't just believe him. Check things out, make the phone calls. It doesn't hurt. People answer questions. Previous employers never have a problem answering questions about their past employee. Criminal records checks available on the internet, but you can ask him what was the disposition of each of the cases he listed. Well, if they're traffic, it doesn't mean anything, but if they're serious charges, find out what the disposition was. Go to the court. Don't take his word for it. If they said he was found not guilty or acquitted, you can contact that court with the case number, and they can tell you what the final disposition was, probably provide you a copy of it. You might have to go down and get it. It might be available online. It might be free. It might be for charge. But you can bet all you have to do is take the information you've got and investigate it. Make sure that you do, because think of what's at risk if you don't. Be extremely careful on who you're going to put your faith in.
Yes, a lesson that some of us have had to learn the hard way, obviously. So, kind of on a related note to that, why is it important for team members to keep their own counsel and not just blab to strangers or people who don't have a need to know about the about their operation?
Well, there was an extremely quiet, secret group created fairly recently, and they changed their name somewhere along the line. Now, I know about them. Now, I didn't tell anybody about them, and I still won't say what the group was or anything, but it was a secret group, and everybody, I'm assuming everybody knew about it. I knew about it. Now, the funny thing about a secret, Sleepy, if I tell you, can you keep a secret?
I like to think I can.
I can, too. That's the answer. If I tell you the secret, can I expect you to be any more secretive about it than I was?
Absolutely not.
So, if you ask me, I won't tell anybody, but tell me about this organization, and then I turn around and say, Sleepy, can you keep a secret? And You say, yes, I can. And I say, I can too. That closes the door, doesn't it?
Yeah,
secrets have to be. Once you give it out, one person gives it out, there's no telling where it may go. People talk about OPSEC. This is operational security. Integrity says if you have a secret, keep it. Keep it as well as you expect the person that you don't tell to keep it. However you want to look at it, don't say anything.
Okay. Well, how, I'm trying to think how to phrase this. What does a security team do, if anything at all, when one of their members gets arrested?
Well, I think it depends on why he got arrested. He was drunk and disorderly and picked up on the street. You wait until he gets out, and then you be very concerned about what the consequences, find out what the final disposition was. If he gets arrested, as we anticipated might happen to George or Linda or myself, that's a tough call. The team has to decide, can we get him? You know, if you watch, well, last time I was arrested in Florida, I got picked up in Orange County for a charge in Seminole County, so it was an Orange County jail for about 16 hours, and then they transported me to Seminole. Obviously, going to Seminole would be the ideal time to get out, which means if you knew there was going to be a transfer, you just take the place out and deal with the escape then. And that comes within the terms of self-defense, because if you reach the court cases that I have, or the Constitution, for that matter, no person shall be held to answer. That means arrested and held for trial. And even if you're on bail, you're arrested, because if you don't show up for trial, you give up your bail. So no person held to answer for any criminal, no person may be held to answer for any criminal, capital or infamous crime. Infamous crime is but back then would be what we call a felony today. Back then it was described as a year and a day in prison, except under presentment or indictment by a grand jury. That's federal, that's in the Constitution, Fourth Amendment. No person can be held to answer without an indictment of a grand jury. If there's no indictment of a grand jury, how can the federal government arrest me? Now, you have to look at your state constitution and see what provision is there. Do they have a lawful right? There's a Supreme Court decision from 1900 that I've written about extensively. If a law enforcement officer comes to arrest you without a lawful warrant, do you have the right to kill him? Well, the Supreme Court said it may be a misdemeanor, it may be no crime at all if you do, if he does not have a lawful warrant. Now, what's a lawful warrant? That requires a grand jury indictment. And absent a grand jury indictment, so if somebody comes to arrest me, where's a grand jury indictment? You don't have one. Then I would like to get out to my security team. They don't have grand jury indictment. That would make any act they took to recover me and restore my liberty, according to John Badout versus United States, completely legal. Now, everybody talks about giving up their rights. I've not given up any rights. I do question, you know, what are the consequences if I try and defend these rights right now? I've got to make a decision, sometimes in a split second. For example, one time when I was arrested in Florida, I had a 9mm 380 laying about 6 inches from my hand, an AK-47 round in the chamber. Safety was on, but 30 rounds in the magazine, about a foot and a half from my left.
Okay, well,
9mm pistols, and, you know, am I going to pick up a gun and shoot back? No. You started to interrupt me. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I guess the audio cut out of my end. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So you decide what it's worth doing. But if you don't defend those rights, you have relinquished them. You have given them up. The government hasn't taken away. You've acquiesced to their removal. And that's that's where the rubber meets the road. If you're willing to defend your rights, you haven't lost them. You may end up losing your life as a consequence, but you have not lost your rights. And that's, unfortunately, the the difference between 1900 John Bad Elk and today, where a lot of people have lost their lives, including George and Linda, because George and Linda were defending their liberty when they shot the cop.
Wow. Okay. So, I guess kind of segueing into George and Linda then, what does a security team do when one of their members gets killed?
Well, again, weigh the consequences. George and Linda were in Alabama. The security team, except myself, were in Florida, Orlando area, and I was in Connecticut. There was no possibility of immediate response. Now, understand that they shot a cop. What's the most severe crime in this country? If you shot the president, you'd probably be better off than if you shot a cop, at least in the eyes of the cops, right? So there was virtually no chance of creating an escape situation for George and Linda. Now, I went down to Opelika after I left the Golden Hill Pekisik Reservation and talked to Linda's attorney, not George's, and he arranged for me to spend some time with Linda alone. He and I went down. He told the sheriff or the jailer that I was his assistant, and we went in and talked to Linda. He left, and I was there another half an hour or 45 minutes with Linda talking about things. But that's the best I could do, and I talked with her about it, and she realized there's nothing we could do at that point. If you could catch him in transport, perhaps you can. If they're in a small jail, perhaps you can. Personally, nothing that we could do unless we had an armed force of a couple hundred people surround that building and threaten them with demolition if they didn't acquiesce and let out the prisoners that we wanted. So, you know, the days of the old wooden jail with metal bars on them, you know, five metal bars are gone. You know, when the horse pulls the bars out of the window, those don't exist anymore. So, you do what you can. Now, I tried to help from the outside. I suggested that they use John Bad Elk for defense, but they opted for the missing 13th Amendment. And, it didn't work. You know, I've got a lot of information on my page about George and Linda, but, you know, it's basically a done deal. The government wanted to kill these people, so they murdered them by under the guise of capital punishment. But they were wonderful people, and they were good people to have on your side.
Okay. All right, since we're starting to wind down a little bit for this particular episode, how can someone start their own security team?
You know, I was probably the fourth member of the team. I don't recall. I think I know who it was that came up with the idea. And I think I knew at the time, but I don't recall now. But if you've got some people you trust, you just start talking to them about it and create the security team. I can't give you a form. You have to know if you trust the people and how well you trust them, and you know, you've got to put all the pieces together.
Okay, wow. I'm absolutely blown away by what you've been detailing to us tonight about how a security team actually works, and I can't thank you enough for coming on and really describing what it is, because I have never heard about security teams before I ever got in contact with you, because you know, the only options that were presented to me and a lot of other people were, you know, you either have to be in a militia unit or you have to be in a survivalist retreat group or maybe even a guerrilla band, or you're out on your own ass just by yourself. So your presentation of what a security team is a refreshing option.
You broke up there. You did mention one other. What if a security member team gets killed, say, by the government? And this is something, when I got back to Florida, I talked about a couple of the other members. And we contemplated retaliation. But the risk was too great to retaliate. I just wanted to get that in. And you have to consider how great is the risk. The cop they got in the confrontation with was Motley. He died. It is possible, had we identified the cop that arrested them, but hey, they were surrounded. You know, they went down a road, and I guess it was a dead end, and they were surrounded by cops. So there's no individual cop that got them. But the possibility of retaliating against a cop that had arrested them, had he been identifiable, was one thing that we did consider at the time. I just wanted to get that in. And again, in defense of their lives, the government can kill you for killing a cop, and you can kill a cop for killing your friends. I think that's fair. I don't think the government is senior to us by a long shot. I think we're senior to the government.
And I think a lot of people would think that's fair, even though that may not be a very popular thought. But I was merely just saying that I think it's wonderful how your description of what a security team is presents another option to those of us, because the options that are presented us through the years to me and as well as to other people is that you either have to be in a militia unit or a survivalist retreat group or maybe even a guerrilla band, or you're just out on your own lonesome. But the notion of a security team is very unique and I think can really help people, especially when there's not a lot of infrastructure to help them use any of those other options. So I thank you very much for coming on tonight and telling us what exactly security teams are.
Well, thanks for the invitation, and I hope that at least some of the people out there can learn a little and perhaps, you know, what we did is it was spontaneous. We created what we felt suited us. It gives you a general idea. You don't have to be as harsh as we were. You don't have to be, you could be harsher than we were as far as what your intentions are and what your purpose is. But as far as a group of people working together in this country today, I don't think that anything can provide the internal security that a security team concept provides. The militia does not at all. Every militia that's been busted has had the informant in the group, from the Viper Militia and back in the 90s, and the West Virginia Militia to the Hootering Militia. They always had the Republic of Texas, Richard McLaren. They've always had their informant in place. And I'm going to guess that 10 to 60% of the Patriots are informants or have the government's best interest at heart. And I'm going to guess also that any militia composed of more than five people probably has an informant in it. I don't believe that our security team was ever compromised.
Wow. Okay. Well, again, I'd like to thank you again so much for coming on and describing how this how a security team works, because, again, I have never heard about security teams from anywhere else in the alternative media. So this is a very unique, and I really thought this was quite a fascinating and very valuably unique topic. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting.
All right. Thank you, Gary. Well, folks, if you found tonight's episode or any of our other broadcasts valuable to you, please consider donating to us here at OPF Radio. You can look for the PayPal button on the right-hand side, which is located at www.outpost-of-freedom.com/radio, and clicking the PayPal donate button. And one more time, that is outpost-of-freedom.com/radio. We are listener supported. We don't work for the government or the corporate media. So please help us stay independent as much as possible by donating to us today. Thank you very much. And catch us about 2 weeks from now. I think we're going to have I believe our next episode is going to be about martial law. See you then. Bye-bye.
I had a dream the other night that, didn't understand. A figure walked in through the mist with a flintlock in his hand. His clothes were torn and dirty as he stood there by my bed. He took off his three-cornered hat, and speaking low to me, he said, "We fought a revolution to secure our liberty. We wrote the Constitution as a shield from tyranny. For future generations, this legacy we gave. In this, the land of the free and home of the brave." The freedoms we secured for you, we hoped you'd always keep. But tyrants labored endlessly while your parents were asleep. Your freedom's gone, your courage lost, you're no more than a slave. In this, the land of the free and home of the brave. You buy permits to travel and permits to own a gun. Permits to start a business or to build a place for one. On land that you believe you own, you pay a yearly rent. Although you have no voice in saying how the money's spent. Your children must attend a school that doesn't educate. And your Christian values can't be taught according to the state. You read about the current news in a regulated press. And you pay a tax you do not owe to please the IRS. Your money is no longer made of silver nor of gold. You trade your wealth for paper so your life can be controlled. You pay for crimes that make our nation turn from God in shame. You've taken Satan's number. You've traded in your name. You've given government control to those who do you harm so they could burn down churches and seize the family farm and keep our country deep in debt. Put men of God in jail. Harass your fellow countrymen while corrupted courts prevail. Your public servants don't uphold the solemn oaths they've sworn. And your daughters visit doctors so their children won't be born. Your leaders send artillery and guns to foreign shores and send your sons to slaughter fighting other people's wars. Can you regain the freedoms for which we fought and died? Or don't you have the courage or the faith to stand with pride? And are there no more values for which you'll fight to save? Or do you wish your children to live in fear and be a slave? Oh, sons of the Republic, arise, take a stand. Defend the Constitution, the supreme law of the land. Preserve our great republic and each God-given right. And pray to God to keep the torch of freedom burning bright. As I awoke, he'd vanished in the mist from whence he came. His words were true. We are not free, but we have ourselves to blame. For even now as tyrants trample each God-given right, we only watch and tremble, too afraid to stand and fight. If he stood by your bedside in a dream while you were asleep and wondered what remains of the freedoms he'd fought to keep, what would be your answer if he called out from the grave? Is this still the land of the free and home of the brave? God bless you, and God bless this room.